Ah, yes. Welcome to the Futile Podcast. I'm Ian, and with me today, of course, usually is Zach, who's got his Kirkland milk. I've never seen Kirkland milk. I didn't know
You're
that.
Right, and it comes in oil cans.
It does. It comes in... You have to use a funnel to properly pour it into a glass. You want to talk about Gran Torino right now? We just watched that. It's Clint Eastwood's swan song, quite literally. There is a song at the end about swans. They show a lake.
How long have you been working on that?
I just came up with that. I did, actually.
That sounds like... That was bad enough that it sounded like you've been honing it.
But I didn't.
Like, in front of a mirror in the bathroom for weeks.
No, it didn't. How did I know it ended with a lake?
I don't know.
I didn't even know
you could have been lying to me about not spoiling stuff for yourself.
But I don't. To me, it defeats the purpose, because usually, if I sit down and read, like, an episode guide for something, like a TV show that I think is interesting, as I read through it, I'm like, oh, that just sounds kind of whatever, humdrum. But you have to see things. It isn't a movie. It's not a book. It's a movie.
You can find really detailed synopses.
Sure you can, but it doesn't... But are you going to sit there and read something super thick if it's just for a fucking TV show? I don't know. I'd just watch it instead.
I would. But instead of watching Lost... I've actually just read...
The Wikipedia or whatever?
Yeah.
Well, I could see that for something like that.
I don't want to sit there and watch Lost. I want to know what happens in it.
You want to see a condensed thing. I honestly don't see how you could follow something like that, because it would be like... It seems like it'd be too many, like, loose ends.
I'd probably have to draw pictures of the characters' faces and then put their names under it.
And you'd have to use string, and you'd have to have a special room where you, like, push-pin pictures with string to show the interconnectivity.
When I was a kid, reading a lot of P.G. Wodehouse books, I would actually... get a piece of paper out and draw what I thought the characters looked like and put their names under them. And so when I was reading, every once in a while I could look down and be like, oh yeah.
To remember.
Not because it was confusing, because I just wanted to see what they looked like when they were talking stuff.
That's funny.
Yeah, so I'd draw what they looked like.
That's the cinematic mind right there. Okay, so.
I think most of the men ended up looking like Clark Gable.
Probably. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of what House looked like on the Masterpiece Theater. Jeeves and Wooster, right?
He had a mustache, but otherwise, sure.
Yeah, I know he didn't have a mustache.
He had dark hair, I guess.
If it was all slicked back and stuff. He just looked like
Clark Gable was a handsome man.
Very well.
You know how you got to start, right? I know I've said this many times.
You said something about an HJ or a DJ.
He performed some sort of J on a studio head to get the job in Gone with the Wind.
That's rough.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
I suppose.
Sometimes you gotta put stuff in your mouth you don't want to.
And speaking of the old studio system, people, and the way things used to work back in the system, we've got Clint Eastwood here, Gran Torino. Started years ago on old television shows, Gunsmoke and Rawhide. Actually, I don't know, was he in Gunsmoke or am I just wrong?
Maybe he wasn't in Rawhide. He might have just been in one.
Started directing stuff with Play Misty for Me, which I've heard is kind of a good cop PI movie or something.
It's a psycho girlfriend thriller.
Oh,
seen it a few times. It's interesting.
Check it out.
The most interesting thing about it for me was because I've gone through Carmel and Monterey area a few times, and I like.
He was mayor there. My parents were married.
Yeah,
there.
It was all shot there, and it's crazy. Like,
was he mayor when he shot it? Like,
mayor yet of Carmel when he honorary mayor of Carmel or whatever? Because I don't even think it's really a. It's not even really a place
that
you need a mayor. I don't know if it's an incorporated city or not.
It's just a collection of golf courses that are loosely connected with.
I don't know if Carmel had any golf courses. Pebble Beach has a ton of them. That's like 10 minutes away from Carmel. Carmel's mostly just rich houses. And like, it was weird like driving through it because you come around this curve and there's just trees and this beautiful ocean right there and just massive houses like peppered everywhere. And then like you kind of just drive down to the middle of this intersection. And the intersection is a few stores and a gas station. And then, like, it just goes on to, like, beautiful houses. And that's it. That's Carmel.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Living the dream, I suppose. Yeah. And there's a handful of other Clint Eastwood films I'd like to see. I'm kind of weak on my Clint Eastwood filmography.
His directing style is very earnest and straightforward. He seems to have the same cinematography, despite the fact that he uses different cinematographers. There's always a... He subscribes to the Spielbergian, always move the camera. Don't let it sit unless it's a close-up of someone's face talking. Mm-hmm. Spielberg will even kind of break that rule very often. If you ever watch Jurassic Park 2, you'll notice that there's not a single moment where anyone's talking where the camera is standing still. It's always slightly panning, or not panning, but dollying to the left or right. Eastwood's, and he seems to pick scripts that have very, I'm not going to say choppy, but forced dialogue. There's always forced dialogue.
Well, like there's, Mystic River kind of has some
of that. Yeah, there's lines in it that no one would ever say in real life. They're very literary style.
Yeah, it's that. It's definitely that. You get that in a lot of... I get what you're saying.
Yeah. You know it's an Eastwood movie by watching that. This movie, incidentally, looked just like Mystic River and
it was a little Million Dollar Baby. It was more, more yellow. And Million Dollar Baby is blue as all hell.
Well, but besides, there's always gray in it, though.
Yeah.
It's The same lighting. Like he really likes a certain look for his stuff.
Which I feel is oddly stylized for someone like him. Don't you think? Don't you think it doesn't...
No, he's always had a decent sense of style. I mean, I can't name one thing he ever
did. I'm not saying... I just think his older films, and I probably haven't... Couldn't really speak to it, but like what he maybe did in
the 80s. Have you seen the westerns he directed or anything?
Well, Unforgiven, yeah. It has
Pale Rider and...
No, I haven't seen that.
Hang 'em High. Or not Hang 'em High, but... what's the one... Oh, the awesome one. The one that's all like allegorical. The Red Town.
I don't know.
What was it called?
I wish I had my computer.
Anyway, it's awesome. Mm-hmm. That was one of the ones he directed also. And, not Pale Rider.
But you're saying that even in those 70s westerns, he still had that sense.
It wasn't nearly as... desaturated.
And
it wasn't.
Stuff.
Yeah, it wasn't anything.
That's
like that.
What I mean.
All that stuff. But no one did that stuff though, because not until
I know. And I'm saying it seems weird that he decided to jump on the bandwagon with that.
And he thought it looked good.
I guess, but
he was like, I want a piece of that.
And so he said it
in a gravelly voice.
Everyone's kind of familiar with his approach. His very quiet on the set style. Mm-hmm. Seems like he's very matter of fact. Because if you think about it, this film came out 2 months after the last one he did, The Changeling? Maybe there was a scheduling thing there and he really did have a full length breadth of time to do them both, but he could have just been really efficient and just made both of them quicker than normal.
They might have been very efficient. Changeling waited a long time to come out, I think.
Okay.
I think that was finished a while ago.
Well, it's possible because of the subject matter that if something happened in the news, they wouldn't want to, you know.
Yeah.
It's always rough with stuff like that about child abduction and things. But this is supposed to be his final acting gig, right?
That's what he says, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, because we both sort of agree that looking at him, he's...
He just looks like... His face looks like a skull. With thinly draped skin hanging off of it.
Indeed.
And eyes kind of protruding from under folds of flesh. And
he's, what do we think? Is he in his mid-70s?
He's in his early 80s.
Or his early... Yeah. Oh, wow, his early 80s. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I knew he was up there.
And I was telling you as we left the theater, Sean Connery's the same age as him. And the last time I saw a picture of Sean Connery, which was from like a year ago, he looked perfectly good. He looked like, you know... You could have sex with him still right now.
Mm-hmm.
You personally could have sex with him.
Okay. Thanks for that.
Yeah. No, he, you know, like, Eastwood, I know people age differently. You know, some people, and Sean Connery doesn't look like the usual
Scottish person. Well, he's got the beard, right?
Well, yeah, he's had a beard, so that covers some stuff up, I guess. But Eastwood, well, like, he looked, like, he kept raising his arms in this movie, mm-hmm. and there's, like, this massive, like, vein and all the skin sagging into it. Like, his arms look awful, everything about him. I don't even want to imagine what his genitals look like. Connery, though, has relatively smooth, you know, his... I always thought he tanned a lot, but he just has darker skin, which is weird for a Scottish person. He probably has a different ancestry than just Scottish.
Possibly.
I mean, after all, he's Egyptian and Spanish, right?
That's right. He's Ramirez, the time-traveling alien Egyptian.
Uh-huh. All right, well, take us through this movie here.
Okay. So Gran
this is
Torino,
your podcast, after all.
Gran Torino is the name of a car, 1972 Ford automobile with, what were they saying, a Cobra engine in it?
Oh, who knows? Yeah. I don't know anything about cars, really.
It's his old car that he loves because he was a Detroit...
He actually built that car in the assembly, or he put the steering column.
Motor man, yeah. He that was his job, I guess. I think they switch people off. They don't
probably
do all of. Yeah. They don't just do one thing forever
because
of repetitive
crazy.
Motion injury and things like that. So that was his thing. He was a Korean War vet, had a rough time there, and then he came home and in the late 50s, early 60s, and, you know, met a woman that he fell in love with and tried hard to get that to happen, and he got that to happen and started a family and, you know, worked in a Ford motor plant most of his life and then retired. And at this point in the movie, at the beginning, his wife has just passed away, and he's at having service for her, and you can tell he's kind of uncomfortable, and
because he doesn't like any of the people there, and he thinks they're all disrespectful, and he doesn't like their newfangled.
It's parts of that. Parts of it are that, and the other thing, what I was getting from it, even before they made it explicit, was that he was doing this for her, and this was not something that he would ever do.
He doesn't like people.
Well, I mean, he did a church service or anything. You know, it was all he was just the whole thing, even the big. The wake, you know, at his house and everything. It was just like he was just being polite one last time for her, and even that he could hardly pull off, you know. He didn't abide very well the general disrespects of his grandkids, which I felt was like, I don't know, I had a problem with that. It seemed a little too, like, subtly over the top, if you know what I mean. Like if the kids are going to be there in the first place, you think that the parents are going to, like, get him to shape up just in all the way for like just 2 hours. You know what I mean?
Well, it's
like, dress nice, take the ring out of your nose, dear, and pay attention and be good for just a little bit.
Because funerals and such. I've been to some. I've been to weddings where there are people who let their kids come in whatever, playing Game Boys, doing whatever they wanted. You're not supposed to wear hats in church, generally.
That's true.
And I've been in many churches and church services where kids came in wearing...
like ball caps and
stuff? Wearing hats, and they were listening to their iPods, and they have, like, you know, gang clothes on and stuff like that. And they're just, like, white suburban kids, you know, and their parents obviously didn't. You know, some parents don't raise their kids without, you know, with any sort of semblance of... teaching them respect for anything.
I could get that part of it, but I didn't get from the minor bit of characterization of his two children, you know, who are obviously old now, are raising their grandchildren, that they seemed like the kind that knew that, and that they would have raised their kids well enough to at least get them to, like...
But you remember at the end, he's telling the priest.
Yeah, that's
right.
He
didn't spend time with his kids, and he didn't know him. He didn't connect with them.
That's possible. But okay. Well, anyway, it's a minor point. It it works to sort of create this. You know, he's old and he's not with the new fangled stuff with the granddaughter that's got the pierced navel and the nose ring and is on her iPhone all the time. And you know, he just doesn't know how to connect with him anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a reality of generational gap. That happens to a degree. At that point, he's sort of left alone. He's got his house that he and his dog, and the priest that keeps kind of coming back and bugging him because he'd promised his wife before she died that he would get him to go to confession.
Get old Walt a final confession.
Yeah, and so for the first part of it, it's just kind of. I don't know, stuff happens. And then you switch from Walt's situation to this this situation of this Asian family. I guess they're Hmong. That's
Hmong.
The name? Hmong?
Hmong.
Okay, Hmong. You know, you see how their traditions work, and they have a big family, and apparently there's a whole bunch of them that live in this neighborhood. So it's not like a bunch of people living in one house. It's one family that lives in that house. You know, it's a grandmother and mother, and the father's dead, and there's a brother and a sister.
Right.
And you'll see a lot more people in the house a lot of times, but that's just because these people,
they
communicate with each other. It's their community, and so they have big barbecues and things like that.
You kind of get throughout the whole thing that he's one of the last white people in not just this neighborhood, but it seems like almost all of, is it supposed to be Detroit?
It's some sort of a suburb in Michigan. Yeah. So yeah, it's that.
And you get the idea that, like, you know, one of the things that he's concerned with is that this used to be his town, his home. Obviously, you know, he makes comments about his son buying Japanese cars and
selling them.
And selling Japanese cars, and it's just like kind of the it's not just a generational gap, but it's a generational change, and it's the same thing. Anytime he's in one of his movies he directs, it seems to be like he must have been thinking that he was dying for a long time. that he was going to be dead soon for a long time because
well, he was just Unforgiven,
like most of the movies he's in, where like he's because he's been an older man for a very 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 long time now, and the same theme in a lot of these is you know it's hard for someone who once the world was theirs. You know, at one point the world was theirs, and now it's belonging to a new group of people, and it's just, it's totally different and strange, and it's hard for the person
What do you do with that guy?
Yeah, to let go, and what is he? Yeah, he's, it's like the Wild Bunch thing, you know?
Exactly.
Like, well, what room is there on Earth for this person?
You know, presumably it's to go live in a home, or move to Grosse Pointe with his terrible, terrible grandkids, right. or whatever. What's the real... I guess the real inciting event is when the local gang, the Asian gang, tries to jump one of the, you know, the neighbor kids in by telling him that he needs to go steal the Gran Torino, the nice car, from Clint Eastwood's garage. So the kid fucks it up, because he's not a thief. He's not really good at that. He's nervous and whatever. And Eastwood comes down there with his old... his rifle.
Like his Garand.
His Korean rifle.
His M1 Garand.
Yeah, and... damn near kills the kid, but the kid gets off and runs away, and then later on, the gang's like trying to tell him that he needs to do it again, and it creates a scuffle, and so then it all happens very publicly out in the front yard, and Eastwood comes out there and kind of kicks the gang out, and slowly but surely, it kind of becomes like a Karate Kid formula, where it's like there's this kid who doesn't have a father figure, who's kind of a weakling, he doesn't like look people in the eye, and he doesn't speak up about anything. And he's the kind of kid that's getting pushed around, you know. He's gonna end up in these gangs, just because even though he's a smart, nice, soft, gentle kid, if something doesn't intervene to sort of push him away from that and show him that there's something else he can do and all that, and that's kind of what the formula is. I mean, eventually, through his sister, through the kid's sister, call him a child. You know what? That was one thing I had a problem with in the film. He wasn't young. I got the impression that he was like 17, a high school kid or something, like, but 16, he didn't 17. Ever go to school, so maybe it was summertime. Yeah. But it seemed kind of like the foregone conclusion that, like, you know, you need to be getting a job, like as a full-time thing or something. I didn't get the sense that, like, he was still, like, a kid, even though he seemed like a kid.
He was 18, I don't know.
I couldn't figure out. There was a point of confusion. But his sister was kind of, you know, very strong-willed, and so she was determined to thank Eastwood's character, old Walt Kowalski, and so she eventually got him over to a barbecue, and
he seemed
started to warm up. I mean, it's one of those cases where the old cantankerous guy I think that the racism in the film is. It's got a comedic effect because it's so absolutely, overdone, yeah. But I think it's almost like way too overdone. I mean, certain places it reads as funny, but it doesn't seem like it fits in a movie that's based
realistically. I thought it was pretty good because he never really changes his ways so much in the film as he just becomes more accepting of people, but he doesn't ever change his ways in the process. He doesn't have to change who he is to understand that it's okay to...
Well, I think he still sort of gets, like, there are good people and there are bad people and jerks. And
right, but...
He kind of uses the language, like, I guess in a weird way where it seems apt to him,
well,
to those people.
Here's when it changed for him, is that they show in the beginning, and the entire first act, where he doesn't like anybody at all. There's nobody he likes.
Yeah.
And the only people he seems to like are the ones who... give it back to him the same way he gives it to him. He's got a thing with he can respect you if you give him a little of the old
rather than placating.
Yeah, he doesn't like that. Placating. Yeah. He doesn't like that. Now that's why he doesn't like the Tao kid, and that's why he likes the sister because when he first because she's the one who just gives it right back to him, and so he ends up liking her.
You're all right, kid.
Yeah, exactly. So because of her, he's opened up to the whole family, and he sees. I think he sees like the close-knit sense of family with them that he doesn't have with his, and it's kind of like intriguing to him.
And he has that sort of moment where like he sort of goes up
and
he washes his face and he's like, I have more in common with these people than I do with my own family.
You're right. And I found even though even not the overtly humorous parts in the scene where he goes to the mom family barbecue, it's really funny because He's just kind of walking around this tall old white guy.
Very awkward.
Really awkward. And he just seems to not care. He just walks around. He just stands there and he's looking at people.
Well, I think that's
he's
sort
asking
of his...
her questions like why are these people not looking at you now? He pats the kid on the head, yeah. Which was really weird.
Apparently,
you know,
and, a really bad thing to do.
Well,
that's sort of an old person to like young kids kind of thing. Sort of thing. I don't know. It didn't,
yeah, but considering how much he hated people, that seemed like that was him trying to reach out and be
it
nice.
Was. And then the reaction to that is what was so, I don't know, kind of sincere or something.
Right.
It seemed realistic. That awkwardness and then that scene. And then, you know, he opens up and that's, you know, and everyone, he starts like, you know, it's good food. And and he likes it. And
the reason why
fun.
He goes over there is because he's out of beer.
Yeah, exactly.
And she bribes him with beer. And he's like, oh yeah, why not?
Okay, why not? Yeah. Free beer with strangers. And at pretty much, let's see, at that point is the next sort of motivation or is that the, you know, they've sort of become comfortable with each other on some level. And the boy's mother tells him that he need, you know, sort of forces the boy on Eastwood to repay the honor, stop being dishonorable or whatever. He needs to help. Just sort of be a handyman, help Eastwood out.
Because what keeps driving the plot is the gang keeps coming back.
Yeah, a couple of times.
And they keep messing with the kid, and they mess with the family, and they're you know, everyone's kind of looking for respect in this, except for the characters who aren't. I think where Walt first starts feeling for Tao is when they bring him over, the mother and Sue, mm-hmm. and they go, you know, like, he needs to repay this debt and everything. He's like, no, and he's like... And Tao goes, you know, hey, if he doesn't want me to, he don't have to. And they both turn
and yell at him
and shriek at him in the language. And he goes like, he's like, oh, you know, like, he's letting these women talk to him that way, you know, because that's his thing too. Like, you don't
be a pussy.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think when he first thinks there's something up with the kid is actually the grocery thing. That's just really, like, obvious. You know, across the street, this older woman's grocery bag falls apart, and then these other kids walk by, and they kind of do this obscene gesture towards her, and then keep going. And then he's like, what's up with the kids these days? You know, he just sort of throws out the blanket generalization, kids these days, but then he sees the Tao kid, you know, go over there, and help her, and be real nice with her and everything. And so he gets a sense that, oh, maybe this kid is actually a reasonable kid, right. And he's just in a bad situation.
Incidentally, Eastwood talked exactly like, it seems kind of...
He talked just like Christian Bale from Dark Knight.
the way he talked and the words he used and his language and everything like that was exactly like every old person that I've known. All my grandparents were in their 80s when they died, and... without the swearing and the constant anger and bitterness, mm-hmm. That was exactly how, like, my grandpa... He dressed just like him, too. He dressed like my dad's dad. My mom's dad, not so much. You don't think he generally wore a...
A bathrobe.
A dress.
A gong.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, so you can see his character starting to change. And so while this stuff's going on with the gang and the family, at the same time, the priest keeps coming back and badgering him. And because he's made this promise, he's not going to give up. You know, Eastwood starts to warm to everyone who doesn't leave him alone.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically, like, that, and I think that ties into the thing
the
about, like, the, not just persistence, but the not being a pussy thing. Mm-hmm. Like, if you keep coming back and you don't give up, he kind of has sort of respect for that.
Of
because,
course.
You know, he tells his son and daughter-in-law to go away. They go away. You know, he tells... The priest would go away. He goes away, but then he comes back. And then he goes away, and he comes back. And he's coming.
And the priest kind of engages him for real. And the priest the priest takes what he gives him, and the priest isn't going to turn around and be like, okay, well then fuck you, buddy.
Right.
And earn his respect that way. But the priest does, you know, listen to what he has to say and return, and in his own way kind of give it back to him.
Right.
Especially at that part towards the end. I guess... it's sort of in the second act is when it definitely gets into the full Karate Kid thing, where it's, you know, he's helping.
There's montages.
The kid, and him are working together on things, and it, you know, it seems very clear at this point that he's completely warmed up to him, like he's his grandson or something. And he's, you know, the kid's asking questions about tools.
He does
and,
things to help him and you know, get him a job and
teach him how to. You know, the thing that he really does that for some reason really. Like really seemed interesting to me is that he helps him with like life, You know, even at that party, when he first is seeing him for the first time, and he tells him about the girl, he's like, you know, that girl was looking at you the whole time. Right. You're a pussy. You're weak. I mean, that's like a life lesson he's sort of like administering to the kid a little bit. And then when he's doing, you know, the chores, a little of that happens. But then, but in the barbershop, like him and Drew Crest-dressing brother-in-law or brother, the barber, that guy's good. He's in, he was in Fargo. He was the husband in Fargo, and he was on Carnival in HBO, and he was like an insane guy in that. Yeah, that guy's good. As the barber, they help. They both just like immediately are like so helpful to the kid. I mean, in like a brash way, but in like a actually like they and that I always like seeing that because in order for a real world to work, I mean, in order for a society to function, that has to happen because people aren't just born knowing how to figure stuff out. And to be perfectly honest, you know, the young kids that get neglected by, you know, the elderly people or the fatherly figures that don't teach them things about right and wrong and how to operate in society end up becoming the gang members. And then they end up they become the new paradigm for what's cool. And then the other kids do that. That's the standard operating procedure. That's how you treat women. That's how you treat other people. Well, no,
I think you just take your own completely misguided ideas about what you should do to get respect and to you know have people will just respect you if not fear you, you know, is to and then the idea is like, well, I have to be physically imposing, I have to be violently imposing
And I have to call women bitches. Exactly. And I have to do
to make sure people understand that they're lesser than me.
Because women have learned, as we saw in the trailer too, you know, he's just not that into you. Women learn that if a little boy throws sand in your face, that means he likes you, and so women like jerks, right? No, but then all that's sort of like, you know, fuck that shit, because that's not the real deal. The real deal is what the barber and Eastwood help the kid kind of understand. It's like, here's what you do, you know? And I love, that was hilarious.
That was really
how because you wouldn't
I was
do
really
that.
Surprised by, here's the thing, I knew, as I said before, I spoil most movies for myself before I see them. When I first heard about this movie, I was like, "Dude, this is gonna be awesome. He's gonna
kick ass.
He's gonna have a couple of shootouts. Of course, right? There's gonna be some sweet like Unforgiven type stuff. It's basically gonna be Unforgiven except
or for Dirty Harry 6.
Or it's just gonna be set in Detroit, and it ends up not being anything like you think it's going to. Even though you kind of get the idea by the trailers what it is gonna be and what it isn't, and it still ends up not being quite that. But I don't want to say they fill time, but the way they fill the void that would be there if there was constant threat of violence and violence happening is by really surprising amounts of humor, mostly racism based.
Yeah.
But like in a friendly way, like which I don't know if that's damaging or not. Like I don't know if
I was thinking about that because I think that
it might be kind of damaging that it's so nonchalant, and by the end of it, everyone who's friends with each other is racist or in some way insulting to each other because it's friendly.
And I don't know how much truth there is in that, to be perfectly honest. That sort of, I think that there's a general good-natured joshing of people that goes on, but it's not necessarily based on ethnicity.
And we all do that to each other, but we're very close friends. And I don't know if people I just had recently met and I could get along if.
Well, I guess you get the impression that these are the contractor and the barber
and
Eastwood, and so
they can do that.
I guess they can do that. Though doing that in mixed company is kind of the other funny thing, you know, because he's introducing the kid to this guy and he's doing that in front of him. Like that's
right.
I have some problems with some of that. I think it's a little overdone, possibly for the sake of humor, or possibly to make this sort of odd, sort of postmodern commentary about race relations, which I don't think is necessarily. We're not there yet. You know what I mean? We're not quite there yet. I mean, comedians can use racial slurs like Sarah Silverman or whatever to point out the absurdity of some of that stuff, but at a certain point, it's like it still has like potent historical relevance and meaning, and it's still not okay.
Right. I don't think the movie ever glamorized.
No, it didn't.
The racism at all. And in fact, they made it seem like his initial, like he has his fake racism because he can be friends with people despite the fact that, you know, he can point out that the guy's a WOP or whatever, and the other guy's a Mick, you know, and so on and so forth. But he's actually extremely very racist toward these people, and I think mainly because he
Fought
in the Korean War. Yeah. But he also shows it with the black gang.
And that's where I wanted to wonder. I was really hoping... I mean, I guess they just decided not to do this because maybe they really wanted to keep him as a sort of...
Is have a friendly black
anti-hero. Yeah, yeah. Where was Morgan Freeman in this movie?
No, you know, and that's the thing. And I was hoping that they weren't going to have a black character for him to be nice to.
Because if they did, it would be a cop-out.
Exactly. And you still have the vestige of the fact that this guy's extremely human. Mm-hmm. And he probably is still racist. But he's now graduated from his intense racism of these Hmong people to the type of friendly racism that he has with everyone else.
Yeah, I guess.
Which means that they're cool
with him. I don't know, in the interaction with the black gang members...
Yeah.
I mean, I get the sense from the way he talks to them and the way he talks about them in their presence that it's because they're doing what they're doing. That he's treating them that way.
No, like, and, I mean, like, that he would, that he's immediately not just turns like, from the black gang to the white kid.
Yeah, I don't blame him. I don't blame these guys for wanting to kick your ass.
He said that the kid was trying to go super spade. Uh-huh. That's what he said.
Yeah. It's like what.
When he first pulls up the truck and he goes, "What are you spooks doing?" I couldn't believe it. Like, yeah, it was like...
Yeah, they kept up with all that. And so it'll be interesting to see how that's actually received from, like, you know... I mean, we'll see what Nickel thinks about it.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting.
Yeah. We don't have to go into the end of, you know, spoil this. This is an early release or anything. Yeah. We'll put this out pretty soon.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of early, but not early.
Well, I know, but I mean... Yeah, I mean,
yeah, this is the first release, day it was wide
release. Wide release, yeah. What did you think of the acting in it?
I thought I kind of had a little bit of problem with some of it. I'm not usually.
I don't think Eastwood is great at directing actors. I don't think he's great at directing actors.
The priest seemed very wooden. I guess
the priest seemed like he was just straight. I actually liked that guy and I liked his role by the end.
I liked him, yeah. But at the beginning it just seemed like he was kind of like delivering the. He seems kind of theatrical about his whole take.
There's theatrical. Mystic River is the most theatrical movie ever.
Of course,
made.
Yeah.
I mean that seems to be what Clint Eastwood's thing. It's like, you know what, you might as well play it to the back audience because.
Which is weird because I don't think he really ever came from theater. You know,
he didn't. Yeah. I don't think so.
He
came from TV, though.
Yeah,
and there is that in TV, and especially in the stuff he came from.
That's true. That's where
he first learned it.
Yeah. So. The sister of Tao, Sue.
Yeah.
She some of her lines, some of her brashness was just kind of like too much. It was a mouthful a few times, and she just sort of threw out like this long.
B. Vang, who played Tao, mm-hmm. I thought he was very good because he wasn't a great actor. Because it worked well with his character being so timid and like browbeaten all the time.
So that when he did jump out, he would kind of overdo it.
Exactly. And I thought the parts where he got really angry were the parts that were the weakest in his performance. But everything else I thought was more lifelike.
You know, that's true in everything.
You usually get a kid actor and it's a good actor. Dakota Fanning does not seem like a real person. Haley Joel Osment in any movie does not seem like a real person. Doesn't mm-hmm. seem like a real kid. No matter how smart a kid is, you could have a super intelligent kid and it's still going to act like a kid. It's not, you know.
Yeah.
And in this case, if you get a not-so-great actor, but someone who still knows how to look somebody in the eye when they're talking to them on camera, that's good enough. Because they're going to have the inconsistency of speech and everything that an actual child has.
Yeah, the mumblingness. Yeah. I mean, that was critical. I think that's missing in a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to the Woody Allen level for comedic sake, but fact that, like, listening to this podcast, you can listen to me and I mumble worse than anybody else.
Oh, yeah, you're terrible. Just awful. Are you the one when he said sounded like somebody was eating? Was that you or Mark?
That was me. I was eating. Oh. I was eating a donut the one time I've ever.
And you're the one who bitches when someone's eating on the thing, dude. I thought that's funny. You had a
I did it for humor purposes because we were talking about. Probably a cop movie. But no, I mean, had a little bit of trouble with certain aspects.
That was for the over the top one, wasn't it?
Okay. I mean, for over the top, I'm going to have a donut and I'm going to talk about.
You probably should have been drinking a beer.
Truck driving. I should have been, but I didn't.
So what do you think about Eastwood?
I like him for the most part, just about everything.
I thought this was great because he always plays someone really
archetypical, though.
But that's the thing, is that it worked with his character because usually he plays a growly dude, and it's not for any purpose because he's generally a good guy deep down. Yeah, he just kind of is a little standoffish. But in this, like he really is. So deeply flawed and stuff that the issue is his attitude toward people, and so it fits with the growly thing.
That's true.
And he played it to great comedic effect when he actually literally growled. Mm-hmm. He did that anytime something really bothered him, he would go, And he would, like, slowly get up and, like, you know, he wears anger on his face really well.
That's true.
I thought he was really good. You know, what's funny is that I'd heard a lot of Oscar buzz about him when the movie was first released to the film festivals or whatever it was. And I was like, come on, that's ridiculous. Clint Eastwood's not going to win an Oscar. You know, he shouldn't even be nominated for an Oscar. Because he's, you know, he's one of those...
He does what he does.
He's one of those actors like a Tom Cruise who is like, oh, wow, the new Tom Cruise movie. But you're never going to see a Tom Cruise movie and go, oh, my gosh, that was just mind-blowing. Tom Cruise has been nominated, I think, twice, but he probably should never win a Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, or anything like that.
He was okay in Color of Money.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's stuff like that, you know, and he was good in Rain Man, but that was when he first started acting like Tom Cruise the most, and he got nominated for Rain Man. He didn't, you know, obviously didn't win. Hoffman won. But, Eastwood is one of those actors. Like he doesn't have to... He doesn't have to win an award for you to know he is an iconic actor.
Oh, of course, yeah.
He's one of the greats, you know? Even though...
He's Harry Callahan.
Yeah, he may not be the best actor, but he is one of the greats.
He hits the goddamn system.
So I think this time, actually, he was probably... I would be okay if he gets nominated.
It'll come... he probably will, and I don't know. The win would just be sort of a...
like, here you go, have fun dying. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And maybe they'll just give him a directing honorary one for that or something. I don't know.
I mean, we'll see.
Because politically, I mean,
he's won directing awards.
The Critics' Choice Awards or some shit was on VH1, like, last night, and I had to see it because okay, let's see what Sean Penn has to say when he wins. And he wins, and he goes up, and he was really weird on it. Like, he was very, like, nervous and mumbly. Like,
yeah, he's always nervous and mumbly.
No, but, like, in a weird, like, very, like nerdish, kind of almost nebbish kind of way.
Right.
Didn't make sense with him. And he sort of was very straightforward about it. He didn't, like, go off on some huge tangent or anything like that. Probably figures it's better to keep his mouth shut for a while. But I think that Penn's probably gonna just win. I don't see them
giving...
Yeah, I don't see them Eastwood, because he doesn't really do any... He just does the Eastwood thing, but he does it really well.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's all there is to it. I mean, this story is, like I said, it's reasonably formulaic. There's aspects of it that you wouldn't necessarily...
Eastwood
wouldn't
make something that wasn't formulaic.
Yeah, it's got parts that really work for me. There's a few parts that don't. And then, I mean...
But you know what? You should know all that stuff's coming.
You should
know. Like, you can't go into it and be like, well, this better be better than I think it's going to be.
No. I didn't. You know? I got pretty much exactly what I was expecting. And I liked it. I mean, I got a little more than I expected, you know, because
I did too.
I didn't really think that his relationship with Tao was going to be much more than just a little bit of, you know, teach the kid to, like, stand up straight. It seemed like he really started with the tools and with the barbershop scene. I mean,
and
honestly...
they're able to take the time to develop all that.
If they had cut, like, the barbershop scene, like, that would have been a tragedy. Yeah. Because that was really so important just to see how much he cared and how much barber cared about getting this kid to be, like, a regular person and waking him up.
And it was immediately useful when he goes to get him a job because you know, Tao ends up being very ingenuitive, and he lies about having a problem with his car. Yeah, you know,
blocks cracked. They want to charge me $34.
Yeah, and the guy's like, tell me about it. You know, so he was able to totally use that right there. Yeah,
I mean, and so here's where I guess I just feel. I mean, it's hard to talk about the movie as a fully critical way without kind of giving away aspects of the ending. But I think it can do it without being specific about things. I mean, people probably can kind of figure out what the ending may be, but I'm not going to incite any of that. Just that you're right about the gangs. The gangs are kind of this thing at the beginning, the sort of inciting event thing, and then they kind of salt and pepper back a little bit. For the most part, they kind of disappear, and then you go off and, you know, he has this Karate Kid situation with Tao. And then the gangs come back, like, conveniently, like, now it's time for the gangs to come back and for it to become a drama again and to get kind of melodramatic and for it to kind of go into that sort of... Like, you were talking on a podcast a while back about the sort of comedies that have that sort of, like, they turn and get real dramatic and dark in the later half. Yeah, I felt like... I don't know. The issue with... it seemed like the melodrama at the end... didn't almost feel like it was in the right movie.
I agree.
From the beginning, maybe, but then what it sort of does in the middle, it gets a little lighter, it gets more comedic, and then it just... You know, I guess it's just that the problem with the gang didn't feel like it was as intense and as immediate as it sort of becomes at the end all of a sudden. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like there's like a month there where he's befriending the kid and things are going just fine and there's no gang activity at all. And then out of nowhere, kind of like, the gangs decide to bug the kid again and then shit goes to...
I don't agree with that. They bug him again when they run into him after he's coming back from his first day of work.
Yeah, but that is like...
That's the first time he's been out. He's been working with him for 2 weeks. I don't agree. I think it's very tonally consistent with that. Nice. And I also love that you keep drawing comparisons to Karate Kid.
Yeah.
Let me turn my lights out for.
Because I
like that on.
I watched Susie Orman on Oprah yesterday, and she was talking about...
She's retarded. Unlike Karate Kid, the kid, you know, he's not teaching the kid how to win the fight in the end.
Mm-hmm.
He's teaching the kid so the kid doesn't have to fight.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he's already gone down that road. He's gone past it. He's got, you know, he's got the rust lung.
Mm-hmm.
So he needs to find the man's way to finish this thing. And he does.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. I love the ending. It was good. Except for the very ending.
With
the
singing.
With the Clint Eastwood singing. Which, as I said to you, was equal to... You finish a great movie like The Departed about rats. And then... Just in case nobody got it, you had a rat run across the screen to finish the thing.
That to me seems...
They should have then cut to a shot of Scorsese, like, thank you for watching my movie. This was about a rat.
Yeah. It was about the sinister side of human nature.
It's typified by this rat I have right here.
And here's my friend, director Brett Ratner.
I really hope they aren't friends.
I don't think they are. No, yeah, that was an inexplicable flaw in that film. And in this film, the singing, I had some problem with it, but at a certain point, I just kind of went with it. And was just
I wanted to laugh, but out of respect, I didn't.
I kind of did, but then I was kind of like, you know what? I'm just going to leave it.
It ends with a song
entitled
Gran Torino.
Let him do this, yeah.
Being sung by, and barely, you can almost not call that singing.
No, it's kind of it's Waits-esque.
A little bit Waits-esque, except for if Waits was on his last legs. If Waits had several feet in the grave,
mm-hmm.
maybe just his head propped up out of the grave singing, that's what it would sound like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then they switch to some British kid that sings the rest of it.
Yeah, some British kid. And the song, in a classic case of nepotism, the music was all made by Clint Eastwood's son.
Really? I thought that he did the own music.
No, it was,
usually Eastwood does his own score, right?
Yeah, it was. This was Kyle Eastwood.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it's his kid.
Well, then they work well together. I don't know, whatever. Yeah, I'd have to say, I think I'd just give this a B, which would be, and the star system that Mark and I use would probably be a 3.5.
I'm going to give Duran Trino an A-.
What did you feel? What was your take on it?
I enjoyed it. I felt the acting, for the most part, sucked, other than Clint. There were two actors in the movie that didn't bother me so much.
It was kind of all very authentic, though. It was kind of like...
The barber and Clint. Authentic.
Well, I mean, like, they weren't... I mean, Zach had a good point that, like, the kid in the movie... If he had been, like, trying to portray, like, something, it wouldn't have worked as well as just him being sort of a snot-nosed kid that was kind of sort of yelling and weird. And I kind of have to agree
about it. He was very awkward.
Yeah, he was awkward. And it would, if he had been...
not a very good actor, though.
If he had been acting, I think it would have read too much. I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah, but there were plenty of parts that were over the top.
Yeah.
Sometimes he looked like somebody... An amateur would look trying to act, trying to look over the top.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't play very well. When you're really going psycho or crazy or whatever, you don't act like that. I mean,
I guess it depends.
Everything just felt very
on how
contrived
you are to acting that way, you know what I mean? If you're used to acting over the top, then you would be less
contrived. Well, I've seen plenty of people.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, the gangbangers, just,
sounds like you didn't like it. Because
I
agree with you.
I was happy just to get another opportunity to watch Clint Eastwood on the big screen. And he was awesome. I did enjoy the fact that he didn't didn't clean his language. No, it's just I enjoyed the character. I could certainly understand his various frustrations, but the fact that he was still open to new ideas.
I think just that part worked for me, like the way that he was sort of brought in. It seemed to work, you know. It wasn't too contrived. I mean, he sort of observed that the kid was the only kind of nice kid in the neighborhood that wasn't going to just pretend to have sex with some old lady behind her back when her groceries were all over the floor. He was going to actually go and help her and that kind of thing.
But yeah, I loved it when he went into, or when he laid into that white kid.
Oh yeah, that was awesome. That was the best.
I think he called him a pussy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a nice 45 he had, too. He had two really nice weapons there. Either one's worth a considerable amount of money.
Cool. So you enjoyed it, then? Just because you enjoyed seeing Clint?
And that's an awesome car, too. Never even really talked about the car, but... Yeah, the 429 Cobra Jet. Big block.
Looks like a nice car.
Yeah, shit. A car like that these days, and that's kind of the odd thing, is it's definitely one of the lesser-known muscle cars.
Okay. So you give it like...
Or a 4.5.
4.5. Excellent. Yeah, so get out there and check it out, Gran Torino. It's definitely worth the watching.
If this would have come out in Humboldt in the actual calendar year 2008, I would have had this in my top 5.
Your top 5?
Yeah, for the year.
Well, I don't think I would have. Definitely. But... Then again, I'm not really the drama guy, I don't know.
You're a drama queen, kind of. Or you're just a drag queen.
Okay, fine.